Chapter 15, A Night in the Life. About the only good thing you can say about a 50th birthday is that it beats the alternative. 50th birthdays are best spent in the company of people you don't have to, and in fact could not possibly, lie to about your age. People who are well aware of that round number that has suddenly attached itself to your personal biography like a fat, loathsome tick. You want relatives for this party. It was a good 50th birthday party, as far as it's in my experience to say. We celebrated at the Clear Lake Cottage where we had passed happy summers. Our old friend Diane Cooper had lent it to us for a week. My birthdays always were a little bittersweet, coming as they did in the last week of August, providing a final benediction for summer vacations almost complete. My birthday was traditionally a time for corn on the cob, and now that I was all grown up, there was no longer the horrible possibility that some well-meaning fool might make me a birthday present of new school supplies. Someone did, however, insert a big plastic spider into some gift wrap. I screamed and jumped, and everybody howled like old times. On this night, the nostalgia was a little too much for Dad. He was uncharacteristically blue. Mum had been unable to join us. The difficulties involved in bringing her along on the 70-mile drive, bringing the necessary gear for her tube feedings and medication, laying out contingency plans for any emergencies, had led her to fits of anxiety. When I assured her that everyone would understand if she didn't make the trip, there was relief, but guilt too. "I'm sorry," she whispered. There was another problem. We had a nursing shortage. Mum's needs were outdistancing available resources. In our determination to keep Mum at home, we relied heavily on the professional services offered by our neighbor, Donna Hamm, through her private company, Caring Companions, and for the rest, relied on nurses from the provincial government's home care program. Everyone had been performing heroically, but this month, there were problems. Home care services were overtaxed, and Donna's people were not licensed to provide overnight nursing care. If we wanted to enjoy a family holiday at Clear Lake, each of us would have to take overnight shifts watching Mum. My shift, it just so happened, began late on the evening of my 50th birthday party. Around 9 p.m., I offered my thanks, cursed those responsible for the plastic spider, said my goodbyes, and left for Brandon. I had the dark, unlit highway almost to myself, battling the vicious crosswinds of an incoming summer storm. I tried not to be anxious, but I was afraid. They look after us when we are children. We repay the favor when they're old. That's the simple, circular formula celebrated in touching fable and humorous greeting card. But this is not the old country, and the scales are rarely that balanced. Those of us lucky enough to be shepherded through our foolish youth by good parents are hardly ever forced to pay our bill in full. Infirmity is usually mercifully brief. Modern families have access to resources that ease the burden, often completely. Nursing our elderly parents is not a given anymore. As Mum's health declined, we were determined to keep her at home. She dreaded the hospital and gained strength from familiar surroundings. Even as her precious ability to control her own environment slipped away, she maintained what control she could. It could be inspiring, as when out of nowhere she would suddenly remind Dad of some obligation or appointment he might have forgotten, still running the household even as she struggled with basic functioning. But her independence also meant getting out of bed for no discernible reason, intent on tackling some task she could not articulate. We lived in dread of the serious nighttime fall. A baby monitor sat beside her bed, as well as a bell she was to ring to wake Dad if she needed help. In fits of anxiety, she might ring for reasons she could not explain when help arrived. There were times when dreams and reality would blur for her, and in her terror, the bell would ring. This was Dad's life most days. On occasion, it fell to the rest of us. Tonight, my turn. The fear and anxiety raised by the prospect seemed a shameful little secret. How could a son begrudge his mother the care that is her due? I comforted myself with the thought that the discomfort was surely mutual. Already, we had shared a rite of passage we had surely both dreaded. There had been an afternoon, between nursing shifts, when I had taken Mum to the bathroom for more than a simple pee. Lynn and Leslie had done the job before, as had her husband, but I think she wanted to spare herself and her sons the same indignity. I sat her down and helped her up and prepared to clean her with a wad of toilet paper. I was thinking it, but it was Mum who said it. we've come full circle. Helping me through, as always. My mother, fiercely independent as a badger, would surely rather have seen any fate but this. Gradually incapacitated, her ability to communicate decimated, yet not granted the mercy of oblivion. Unlike her own mother, Mum was not spending her final days running for Prime Minister. Inside her deteriorating shell, she was still present, still fighting to punch through, still sufficiently aware to understand how far she had fallen. The wind was blowing hard when I arrived at River Heights. The evening tube feeding was long over, and Gayleen, her favorite nurse from Caring Companions, had put Mum to bed. It required both skill and finesse. Mum's body was gradually stiffening, petrifying. To move her into bed, you first sat her down carefully on the edge, then lifted her legs and swiveled her into a prone position. The toughest part was turning her on her side as she preferred. The first time I tried to wrestle her over, she got panicky and called for Dad. I then discovered that the real experts, Dad, the nurses, had a trick. First, they laid a short quilted sheet down on the bed. Once she was placed on it, they gave it a sharp tug and flipped her on her side. It was a little like pulling a tablecloth off a loaded table, except that in this case, you wanted to accomplish a half turn. Not so long ago, Mum might still have been up watching TV, but she watched less now. Media input had become difficult for her to process. Too much too fast. Even her beloved Toronto Blue Jays had slipped from her list of priorities. She could no longer spare the horsepower required to pay attention. It now required all her focus and energy just to maintain a basic level of operation. Some months earlier, I had landed a short guest hosting slot on a CBC radio program. Mum enjoyed the opportunities such gigs presented. Unlike her husband, she did not knock on neighbors' doors to inform them of the airtime and dial position, but nonetheless, she loved to listen. This time, Dad took the radio into her room so she could hear the show. She asked him to take it out. The sound from the small speaker, the theme music, the competing voices in discussion. Too much. The one-time pleasure of listening to her son on national radio was now just so much signal noise. Tonight, the apartment shook with groaning, whining sound. Dad's big bedroom occupied the top southwest corner of the building, with a bay window jutting south to intercept the wind. When storms blew in from the wide, empty fields that stretched west, the bedroom creaked and rattled like the cabin of an old sailing ship. I lay in Dad's bed, straining to hear the sound of a bell above the din. It seemed impossible that one could sleep in such circumstances. Didn't even seem advisable. I did, though. When it finally came, the ringing of the bell drifted into my consciousness, as though from a wind-tossed ship. How long had it been ringing? I launched out of bed and across the apartment, calling as I went, "Here I am, Mum! I'm here!" There was panic in her voice. "I rang, but you didn't come." "I'm sorry, Mum. Can I help you up?" She turned to me, and her eyes seemed to focus. "Steve," she said weakly, "why are you here?" She was awake now, her native solicitousness returning as the panic ebbed. "How was your party?" "You had to come back. That's not fair." Almost commensurate with her aversion to attention was her desire to be no trouble. Once, when my parents and I were staying in a hotel, Mum had gotten up in the night, tripped over the bed cover on the way to the bathroom, and fallen hard. Next day, she couldn't move her wrist, yet she refused to visit a clinic lest it disturb plans Dad and I had for the day. It became necessary to get tough. No one was leaving the hotel room, we assured her, unless it was to visit a clinic. She finally caved. Turned out to be a serious sprain. There were different rules for different relationships. Her children were her responsibility. There was no price tag, no conditions. She would never demand the payment due. With Dad, it was a little different. 57 years of intimacy meant both trust and obligation. If she was to retain her tenuous grasp on liberty, his help would be required. She had to be tougher with him. His intentions were the best, but he was not exactly a natural empath, and his approach to Mum's well-being generally involved calories. One day Mum was feeling nauseous after a tube feeding, something that happened when her stomach filled too quickly. The nurse suggested she lie down. Dad suggested food. I have a nice half of a sandwich here, he said brightly. Mum looked at the nurse with a grim smile. He just doesn't get it, she said. As Mum's condition worsened, some of the kids showed flashes of resentment toward Dad. While we watched a football game one night, Mum rang her bell. She had become twisted in her bedsheets and was struggling in distress. Lynn and I bustled about, straightening, smoothing, soothing as best we could. You're missing some great plays, Dad called out from the living room. And yet the impression left by such moments was misleading. Dad wasn't callous, just sometimes clueless. His habitual demeanor had always leaned toward the cheerfully oblivious. It explained why the marriage relationship had been punctuated by interventions with Mum periodically grabbing him by the lapels and letting him know that action was required on some behavioral issue. Once brought up short, Dad was always willing to adjust. The adjustments were harder these days. Dad was in his 80s. His heart was a leaky boiler, and lest we'd forgotten, a diagnosis of Alzheimer's had been made several years earlier. Dad had never accepted that diagnosis. As years passed, neither did I. There had been some strange and terrifying moments. After that 2006 trip to the West Coast to visit my sister Leslie and I, Mum and Dad had returned to Brandon and dropped their suitcases in the bedroom. Next day, Dad saw the bags and asked, "Are we going somewhere?" Reminded of the trip, he could not at first recall it, even though he clearly remembered things that we'd done out west. He insisted it was an isolated incident brought on by a moment of fatigue, but we were terrified, bracing ourselves for the horrors to come. They didn't, really. Dad's short-term memory continued to be appalling, but his personality remained unchanged, his practical abilities unimpaired. Besides, Dr. Molecule was convinced Dad had Alzheimer's, and in our family, that was considered solid evidence to the contrary. He doesn't have enough of the symptoms, I once argued to Molecule. Well, Molecule replied, it's still in the early stage. 5 years after the initial diagnosis. Our bad luck in the doctorial lottery had forced us into a more skeptical view of medical opinion. We had become warriors for proper diagnosis and appropriate attention. There was a price to pay for this. As much as we disliked Dr. Molecule, it was clear he did not warm to the sight of Burgesses coming down the corridor either. Still, risking the animosity of our family doctor seemed an unavoidable option. We couldn't afford to relax and let things be. We were concerned about Dad for another reason. He was in charge of Mum. Dad needed plenty of reminders to keep track of his own complex regimen of prescription drugs. He frequently messed it up. Yet he was the last line of defense for our increasingly disabled mother as well, the one who was there when the nurses went home. It was not ideal. But my stormy night, spent lying in his bed, wanting sleep yet fearful of missing the bell, had been very educational. My father, 83 years old, with failing eyesight and an increasingly unreliable neural network, was fighting this battle every day and night, and doing a pretty fine job. In the morning, I got Mum up and into her chair as we waited for the morning nurse to arrive. I disappeared into Dad's bedroom looking for something to wear, finding one of his pajama tops. I threw it on and went back out to sit and chat. Mum looked at me with the implacable gaze that was now hers by default. I'm feeling anxious, she finally said, because I can't remember your name. I'm Steve, Mum, I said as casually as I could, moving over to crouch by her chair. Your son, Steve. You're not Steve, she said. Steve is the youngest. If you're Steve, what does Steve do? I'm a writer, Mum. She seemed to contemplate that for a moment. Steve is a writer, she said finally. You're wearing Dad's pajamas. Apparently that had been my mistake. The pajamas had thrown her. I crouched beside her, feeling the same sort of tingling shock as on that Christmas Eve when I had found her lying on the kitchen floor blinking at the ceiling. There was a knock on the door, and the morning nurse entered. She eyed me as she mixed up the meds on the dining room table. You look like you could use a break, she said. Do you need to take a walk? I did. To be forgotten by my own mother was a rabbit punch. But to forget your own son was surely worse. And it was a particular cruelty of Mum's condition that it did not leave a healing balm of forgetfulness in its wake. When the temporary cloud of confusion lifted, Mum remembered everything that had occurred. That evening, as I put her to bed, she was crying. "I forgot my own son," she whimpered. Chapter 16, River Heights Terrace. For the handful of Second World War veterans among its residents, River Heights Terrace must bring back memories. You never know when the guy next to you is going to buy the farm. Don't get friendly with the new recruits. Best to stay detached. Located on the western outskirts of Brandon, River Heights Terrace is not what we used to call an old folks' home. It is called, officially, a holiday retirement community. Although just when Brandon became a holiday destination is hard to say. There's no nursing provided. Seniors rent the service departments and suites, all with big TVs and no stoves. The motorized chairs gliding silently along the hallways can create the feel of a Doctor Who episode. Three times a day, moto chairs and walkers converge on the huge central dining hall. Better not leave it too late. Residents start rolling in an hour early to grab choice seats. After mealtimes, the walkers jam up at the single elevator like Manhattan taxis at rush hour. The rest of the time, there's bingo, whist, carpet bowling, sing-alongs, movie nights, and the occasional bus outing. Turnover rates are high. The sales force can never rest easy. When residents periodically disappear from view, it's as likely they're in Brandon General as on vacation. Some don't come back. Seems that almost every second week the big noon meal is preceded by the announcement of a memorial service. It's not all gloom, though. They're singing happy birthday to somebody every second day. Stay a while in River Heights and you get to be as sick of that tune as a Chuck E. Cheese waitress. You might expect a place like River Heights to be full of ghosts. Certainly there's a palpable sense of absence as nameplates suddenly disappear from doors and habitual dining table quartets are forced to fill new vacancies. But ghosts? Spirits hovering over the rows of tables, roaming the long carpeted hallways lined with flowery prints, past rows of doorways and parked walkers? Not likely. Ghosts are about passion, an unfulfilled desire. Here, all feels played out, denatured. Any tormented souls currently paying rent at River Heights will do their future haunting elsewhere, in the houses and fields and high schools where their unresolved torments were born. Not that River Heights lacks tension. There aren't enough hormones to truly make it like high school, but with a sedentary population commuting back and forth to the dining area and activity room, River Heights is in effect a self-contained small town. The social dynamic is lively and the gossip unavoidable. While it's hardly a soap opera, unless you're thinking General Hospital, there are characters in residence. And hidden behind prairie stoicism, there is real pain. The residents in this place generally arrive two by two and leave one at a time. Somebody gets left behind. One evening, while heading back to my parents' third-floor apartment, I see a shirtless old man lurch into the laundry room where an elderly lady is busy folding her clothes. "Are you as lonely as I am?" he asks her without preamble. "It's been 2 years since my wife passed. I'm so terribly lonely. But I know she had to go, you know. She was in so much pain. She had leukemia, you know, blisters all over her body. She couldn't even roll over. I couldn't do anything for her. Couldn't do anything for her." I freeze in the hall, horrified, sympathetic for the man, but frankly, more sympathetic for the poor, quiet woman folding her laundry. After all, by his own admission, he's been a widower for 2 years. If this is still his conversational opener without so much as a "how do you do," I would guess he usually dines alone. "That's old Nick," Dad tells me later. "He drinks quite a bit. Most of the ladies here are scared of him." Understandably. Yet Nick's soliloquy is suggestive of more than just social discomfort. Could this be the emotional reality of life here? Could this be the soul of River Heights laid bare? I now recall that I have in fact seen Nick before, sitting with his door open in midday, shirtless, listening to sentimental old melodies. He appears to me an anomaly, the only obvious drunk in the place. But who knows how many grieving River Heighters would make similar confessions but for sobriety and self-control. Particularly among the widowers. Men of that generation are usually said to have a harder time after the death of a spouse. For elderly women, it can be a secret relief no longer having an old man to care for. If healthy, older women tend to be far more self-reliant. Men are more likely to be lost, a fate the family has long feared for Dad. In vino veritas, I wonder if, deep in his cups, Nick may speak for more residents than they would admit. Not that it's all elderly widows and widowers in River Heights. There are at least a couple of young mysteries here. Alan is a short, boyish-looking guy who likes to stay up late in the TV room watching Turner Classic movies. He may be a little older than he looks, but he can't be that old, mid-50s at most. He's one of at least two younger renters here. What brings a younger man into this world? The lack of need for a stove, certainly. Plenty of bachelors would go for the 3 squares a day aspect of River Heights. Still, there's something disconcerting about seeing a man place himself in this milieu decades ahead of schedule. The young stick out here. No visitor bounds up the open staircase that leads from the dining room without instantly feeling self-conscious. Any visible display of strength or agility seems rude here. Young people are intruding. This is a small world with its own atmosphere, and it can be stifling. There's something of the hospital here, a place filled with uncomfortable reminders of the human condition, the kind of place that inspires in some people a near-phobic reaction. Then there are the people who thrive in this environment. In the coffee room, a large woman, in a larger motorized chair, reads obituaries to a friend.
Dorothy Atkinson. Rosalie Boo, nee Simon. Margaret Batchelor, nee Gustafson. Maria Estrella, know her? You know her? That's all today.
This woman is the self-appointed monarch of River Heights. They call her Queen Julia. If you want information about the residents of River Heights Terrace, their health, their comings and goings, Queen Julia is the one to see. How Queen Julia received her nickname is unclear, but as she is perpetually enthroned in a deluxe motorized chair unmatched by any in the complex, it was perhaps inevitable. Her age is hard to determine. Julia is a large woman, with enough facial hair to land a midway job. Queen Julia is served first at mealtimes. This is not because the staff recognizes her royal claim, it's because she makes sure she's first to hit the dining room so as to commandeer the first table. At this point, it's debatable whether anyone would want to take it from her. There would only be hard feelings, and it's unlikely anyone else cares as much anyway. Queen Julia is one of those character studies one makes out of necessity rather than affection. She displays an odd combination of curiosity about her neighbors and ignorance of the world at large. But what curiosity it is. Not a sparrow falls in her kingdom, but Queen Julia knows of it. One day I am sitting in the activity room, reading the paper. Queen Julia is a couple of tables over, sitting with a tall, gaunt resident I don't recognize. But he seems to know me, almost at least.
Is that Joe? The man asks Julia.
No, Julia tells him. Joe is arriving next week with his wife. That's Steve. He's the youngest. It's his birthday today. He and Bill are going to Albert's restaurant up on the North Hill for a birthday dinner.
I had only made up my mind about Albert's about half an hour before. We don't need a newspaper, one resident mutters to me. We have Queen Julia. River Heights Terrace is a bit like a 3-story Stoughton, a simulacrum of the small-town prairie life Mum had found so wearing years earlier. As such, it hardly seemed a good fit, but for the most part, River Heights would turn out to be a pleasant surprise. Mum and Dad's balcony looked out toward nothing but acres of farmland and a broad stage for nightly sunsets. Dad fit in with the social scene right off. The social aspect would not prove to be much of an issue for Mum. The progress of Parkinson's soon locked her in a world even smaller than River Heights. Christmas 2008 did not come heralded with the usual pleasant anticipation. We'd made it through a bad year. The worst, really, though it didn't look likely to hold the title for long. Flying east that December, I tried to imagine scenarios, game plan the ways some of our traditions might survive the new realities. Many know the melancholy of Christmas, the dissonance between public celebration and private reality, the memories that make jolly Christmas trappings seem like cruel mockery. In years past, I'd sometimes shuddered to consider what Christmas carols might mean to me once my beloved Christmas world had gone. This year, it seemed, might offer a preview. I had to assume that this would be my last flight to Christmastown. One thing was certain. This year's Christmas hoopla would consist of whatever I could arrange. Once upon a time, the accumulation of wrapped boxes just seemed to spread naturally as kudzu, claiming more and more living room acreage as Christmas Eve approached. Now, it was mostly up to me. I shopped for others, checked off my own gift list, and made frivolous purchases just to get boxes under the tree. Even now, though, Mum was determined to play her usual part. Weeks earlier, at the close of a visit from Lynn, Mum had gripped her arm. "Christmas," she whispered. "Dad." "A gift, Mum?" Lynn asked. "Yes," she said. "Housecoat. Blue." Her face just relaxed when I said I understood, Lynn told me. She was lying there worrying about it. Now the blue housecoat was in my suitcase ready for wrapping. Bottles of Glenfiddich and Dalwhinnie were easily identifiable beneath the tree. Pajamas and comfortable velour loungewear was accumulating, courtesy of donations from all 5 kids. And I had a mission to run, down to a little trophy store on 10th Street. 39 years earlier, my grandfather's final Christmas had been made by the trophy our cousins got for him. "I don't know, Steve," Lynn said. "Seems a little corny." It did. Our mother had never been one to collect cheesy little tchotchkes. But over the years, we had all learned that Mum's surface reserve could be deceptive. Presented with unabashed expressions of her children's love, she could be overcome. After a 1995 family reunion, we had surprised Mum and Dad with a giant print of a family portrait inscribed with the words, "We love you." 5 years later, on the occasion of their 50th year together, we arranged for a stone bench a few blocks from 54 Clement, inscribed with the phrase, "Mum and Dad, it's been 50 years, so sit." Mum wept when she saw the portrait, and they both loved that bench. They visited it, cleaned trash around it, tended the decorative foliage. It was always instructive to see Mum react to gifts and expressions of affection. The undeniable concrete evidence of our devotion overwhelmed any discomfort and brought her to tears. I picked out a red and gold trophy. Bonus, the shop had little Highland Dancer figurines. I'd been concerned about that. A little gold bowler would not have worked. A golfer would have been worse. I got one dancer for the top and a different one for the middle. Preparations for Christmas Eve involved new complications. Mum's tube feedings were an issue. After the feed bag had dribbled its way through the tube, nurses mixed her evening medications into a big plastic syringe and injected them through the tube, followed by a flush. Problem: the medications included sleeping pills. Christmas Eve, the nurses would not be able to show up late to delay that knockout punch. If Mum was to be able to stay up for Christmas Eve, I had to learn the procedure so as to do it myself later in the evening. A nurse showed me how to crush the meds in a bowl and draw them up into the big syringe. We uncorked Mum's stomach tube and delivered the mix nice and slow, followed by a flush. Mum sat patiently while I learned the ropes. There was some spillage at first, but I got the knack. "Good job," the nurse said. I knew of no standard by which I could calibrate my reaction to this success. Such an unexpected honor. Administering medication through a tube into my mother's abdomen. Nope, I'd never had opportunity to rehearse a reaction. As it turned out, I was rather proud, and Mum seemed pleased. We were ready for Christmas Eve. The tree was up. The days of real Scotch pine were long gone for us, but they're doing some fine things with artificial foliage these days. Mum's baked snack mix had fallen by the wayside. We didn't even have an oven anymore. No one really thought it was necessary to mix up the traditional punch. Frankly, with all the bottles and packets of medication around, we couldn't afford the table space anyway. Santa candles were everywhere, though, and there was a remarkable number of packages crowding the tree. Early in the evening, Donna and Kelly Ham dropped by with their daughter Amanda and her miniature dachshund. Mum loved her a good dachshund. Gayleen, her favorite nurse, came around too. About 2/3 of the packages were for Mum. She was getting enough pajamas and comfortable loungewear to satisfy Hugh Hefner. Dad loved his blue housecoat, and as always, the expensive scotch. In moments of honesty, he would admit that years of pipe smoking had made it a struggle to differentiate the good stuff from Bell's, his bargain brand. But he loved trying, and however it tasted, it was expensive scotch and a token of love. Had we been so inclined, we could have rustled up some old Glenlivet boxes and filled up discarded bottles with cooking sherry. Playing Santa was a full-service job now. Hand out the gifts and open them, too. The tall, roughly wrapped box I finally placed on Mum's lap seemed to inspire in her vague alarm. I peeled the wrapping and wrestled it out of the box, shedding red and gold glory, festooned with Highland dancers, and on its marble base, the corny, heartfelt inscription, "World's Greatest Mum." "Let me get a picture, Mum," I said. She held onto it gamely, her face its now standard mask of grim effort. "Smile, Mum," I coaxed. Her face opened, as if in silent laughter. I clicked the shutter and froze that verdict on Christmas 2008. Next day, Gaylene stopped by to admire the trophy. "It was a close race," I assured her. "Mum was something of a dark horse candidate, split the vote and came up the middle." Mum looked over at Gaylene, raised her eyebrows, and laughed. It might have been a scene from 10 Christmases ago. Behind the frozen mask, between the temporary spells and confusion, our mother was still herself, still there. Mum rallied for evening battles. We even managed a movie night. I'd brought along a copy of The Red Balloon. Made in 1956, it tells the tale of a boy and his pet balloon in Paris's Belleville district. Half an hour long and almost wordless, it was perfect for Mum's precious resources of energy and focus. In the magical finale, our young hero is carried aloft by a cloud of bright balloons without the aid of animation or a single computer. Mum was enchanted, and she made it all the way through. There was a real Christmas dinner at our little dining room table, cleared of pill packs and draped with a new $10 tablecloth. There was takeout soup from her favorite local diner so she could participate fully in the communion. 3 days later, she was once again helped into her black and red Christmas finery to sit down at the table and mark the 58th anniversary of that day when her lovely ankle-length wedding gown had confounded her fashion-challenged groom. The three of us sat at the little table and toasted the occasion. Mum turned to me, speaking carefully. "And to you," she said, "for being so gracious with everything." It had all proceeded miraculously well, a precious and unexpected gift, if not exactly like Christmases of yore. Had I been in a mood to reflect on the lessons of history, it might have occurred to me to compare this holiday season of 2008 with another. It was in the Christmas season of 1944, the German troops surged forward from the Ardennes forest in a last-gasp attempt to drive Allied forces back to their boats. For a while there, the holiday with Hitler was a pretty big noisemaker, but the Germans had been forced to expend most of their reserves of men and materiel. Afterward, they were largely spent. Most military historians argue that the Battle of the Bulge hastened the end for the Führer. And Christmas 2008 probably hastened the end for Mum. Reluctant as I am to compare my mother with the Nazi war machine, there are parallels there. Now it was over. I was packing my bags for the 2-hour shuttle into Winnipeg, and then the 3-hour flight west. Mum sat in her chair, slowly absorbing her liquid midday meal. Timing was always tricky. When the feeding was over, it was straight to bed. I had hoped to say my goodbyes first, but I was too slow. Before I could get organized, the nurse was leading Mum back to her bedroom for a postprandial nap. She was lying down by the time I entered the bedroom. "Mum," I said, bending over and placing a hand on her shoulder, "I have to go." She looked up and managed a smile. Under different circumstances, it might have been called a grimace, lips slightly apart, teeth visible. A bright intensity in her eyes left no doubt that she was bringing to both the effort and the moment as much focus as she possessed. She reached up and grasped me by the lapels. I stayed frozen there, bent over, not wanting to move, yet unsure of how long I could maintain the posture. What I whispered, I can't recall. Finally, I pulled away and turned to go. It would not be our final meeting, but she would never see me again.